On this episode of the podcast, Todd interviews Ricky Hirsch of Think Jerky.
Athlete Strength and Conditioning. I'm here with Ricky Hirsch, the founder of Think Jerky, which is one of the fastest growing food companies in Chicago. He started the company actually almost exactly 1 year ago today. His Kickstarter launched on June 10th, 2015. They actually started producing the jerky about 7 months ago. He's got three chefs on board, award-winning chefs, if you're immersed in the culinary community at all. That's Gail Gann, Laurent Gras, and Matt Trost. And he's got some jerky that we actually carry here at South Loop Strength and Conditioning. As soon as I saw the product, it made sense to me. I was like, okay, yeah, cool. This is jerky that isn't just full of garbage, as the jerky commonly seen in areas such as truck stops is. So I was like, cool, yeah, this is delicious. This is good. Let's carry this thing. Let's sell it. I had no idea this is even a Chicago company. And then I met Ricky at a paleo community dinner. And we've been carrying his jerky. One of my friends helped out with this company. And I think that I'm really interested in how he's actually grown this company, right? Because this is sort of a classic overnight success story. But anyone who's been around people starting businesses, things like that, for a while knows that overnight success is sort of a fake term. So I'm really interested to hear kind of, the story of Think Jerky, but not just Think Jerky, Ricky's kind of story in terms of how he actually created this business that seems to be, taking off at a pretty quick rate. So, Ricky, thanks for being here, man.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, kind of started talking about this overnight success stuff, right? You guys launched this Kickstarter, and you pretty immediately had a bunch of media attention on you, right? You had coverage in Sun Times, Paleo Magazine, all kinds of blogs, things like that, which people just covet that. They're like, yes, I need to be in the media. How did you actually get that kind of coverage? What was your game plan there? Did you plan that, or was that just kind of a happy accident?
I thought it was going to happen. I mean, to be honest, we launched on Kickstarter. I thought we were going to do $1 million. We ended up doing 60 grand, which we were still top five of all time for food, but to me, I thought we were going to do way more. I think in food, people have to try it first. That was the response. But it's interesting you mentioned the media. We got all this media attention. It was literally just me emailing people. I would sit there for probably a week straight just emailing anybody who would, with an email address. I literally probably sent 10 to 20,000 emails.
You didn't email me.
I emailed John.
Oh, okay.
literally emailed everybody. So with the Sun Times, it was kind of a snowball effect. Some publications picked us up and more. But it was interesting because the media attention didn't garner any sales. Literally. Sure. We were in Cranes and we got two people who backed us from Cranes. We were in the Sun Times. We got zero people backing us. We were in Eater. We got one person. And that's what was so confusing to me. Like, everybody thinks, you put something on Kickstarter, it goes viral, you make $1 million. That's what I thought. And that wasn't the experience that I had. A lot of the traffic in Kickstarter is people buying ads, and I didn't know that, and I learned it about three quarters of the way through. It was just a different world. A lot of the Kickstarter world is very tech driven, and I think food is different, but the media attention happened organically by me just reaching out to people. I sent the same email to everybody and saw who would listen. I thought because our story was so unique and compelling that they would have to talk about it.
Sure. Yeah, and we've noticed something similar with media. It's funny. When we first started, we were on a morning news show like within the first few months of like actually running classes, and I was like, yes, this is going to be awesome. And like we got one guy, and he just quit immediately. I was like, the world is not what I thought it was.
Right.
That's funny. So you basically had the experience. Okay, cool. We're gonna hit $1 million on this thing. That was actually another question I have for you, which is, yeah, you raised a bunch of money for a food company on Kickstarter, right? But given your sort of background in the mortgage industry, all that type of stuff, it seems like you probably could have figured out other ways to raise $50,000. So why Kickstarter?
Kickstarter it was partly for the money, and it was more for the marketing.
Sure.
To me, I think every company should start on Kickstarter. Why wouldn't you? If you're going to launch in January, why not start pre-selling whatever product you have in October? One, you're going to be acquiring customers. Two, you're going to be getting revenue, and three, you can get media attention, which you can leverage into more media attention when you launch. So for me, it was just the marketing was the most important thing, and then the money, which was very important to us and necessary, was equal to that, I would say. So I think every company should launch on Kickstarter in terms of the launch board that it gives you when you actually start your, you launch your company.
Sure, yeah. So you're basically, you're taking in money while you're marketing, right? Yeah. So rather than paying to see people, right. People are paying you.
Right.
So it's a double win for you.
Right.
So kind of talked about this, seeming overnight success, but I mean, again, knowing a little bit about your background and all that, you've been grinding away at businesses forever, right? What about your background sort of led you to think?
Yeah, that's a great question. You say overnight success, it definitely was not. I don't believe in that. We've had crazy growth in the past 7 months since we've launched, but I've done everything myself for the most part. We have one full-time employee now, it was great, but everything was me. I designed everything, made everything. And I literally spent 2 years working on this, thinking about it, spending time writing down ideas. So I have a plan for the next 2 years, knowing that I would get to where I am today and not have the mental capacity to think about the future because I have to worry about beef prices.
Sure.
So it wasn't an overnight success. It was not, because I laid a foundation for growth and success at the start. Now, how was I able to do that? Because I had money. Why do I have money? Because I had other businesses which I've ran and sold, and I was fortunate to be in that position, which most people are not. So I recognize the fact that I wasn't a fortunate position in that sense, but I am a self-made guy. I didn't come from that. I made that with the mortgage business, like you were saying, and then my fund, which I started after that, and then food. So how did Think come about? Was that the question?
Yeah, I mean, because I think one of the things that, I sort of saw on my own experience with the product, I mean, people are chasing the mythical product market fit, right? Where as soon as I saw the thing, I was like, okay, yeah, I get this, right? I never thought of making a health-focused jerky product, but, I've been in bands and gone on tour, and you're looking at a gas station, you're like, all right, what am I going to possibly eat here that's not total garbage?
Right.
I'm like, well, this jerky is the best option. So, I mean, immediately it resonated with me where I was like, cool, I've eaten jerky as a pseudo health food, so why not have this as actually marketed to health conscious individuals? This makes perfect sense, right? So it's not like you just stumbled into that. I mean, did you do market research? Were you just scratching your own itch? What?
I mean, for me, the market research was myself and my friends. I mean, I saw what really happened is I've been in sales and finance my whole life. I always thought I was creative. I wanted to go into something creative. So to me, food is very creative. There's a lot of avenues for expression. So I was working on ideas in the food world for probably 5 years. Nothing ever hit. Anything from cold pressed juice to hot dogs to pastries, whatever, you name it. Jerky, I always loved. I grew up on it. And I saw a change in eating patterns over the past 5 years with the paleo community, low sugar and grass fed, and what antibiotics are and what hormones are. And I saw that change. And I had a jerky idea maybe 4 years ago, and I shelved it. And then I saw an emergence with some other stuff in the meat world. And I'm like, I think we can do something completely unique and different. And while I was working on these other ideas that I had, they all had something unique. And then Think Jerky was kind of a combination of all that. It was, all right, let's make it healthy. Let's make it modern. Let's make it gender neutral. The chef thing was something that I always wanted to do, because to me, that's just the brand. That's what's so cool about it. And then combining it, I think portion control is very important. I think, giving people the highest quality food, but in the right amount, is more important than giving someone a 3 ounce bag of meat. It was just really a combination of a lot of things I believe in, and that's why it really makes sense. The 100 calorie thing was actually by accident, ironically. My intention was never to make a 100 calorie pack of jerky. My intention was to make it a single serve portion controlled bag, which happened to be 100 calories. I'm like, wait, that's cool. So that was a happy accident. It's called Think Jerky. The idea is to think before you eat. That's our slogan. It's to think about what you're putting in your body. All of our all of our proteins are antibiotic and hormone free. It's to think about who's making your recipes. Everything is crafted by a chef in a kitchen, not a scientist in a lab. And the third part is to think about your community. I'm a meditator. I meditate every day, twice a day. I've been practicing meditation, transcendental meditation, for 8 years. I've never missed a day. So we give 10% of all profits to the David Lynch Foundation to teach veterans with PTSD how to meditate. So that's the foundation of our business. And I think it's really unique. I mean, when you look at the product, the way we made it, it's the healthiest thing you can eat in the sense of if you want protein. It's 100 calories, 16 protein, 6 carbs. The chef thing is very cool, but if you take away the chef component, it's just a really healthy jerky. We got named healthiest jerky in the country, so we're a healthy jerky. But the chef idea and the power that brings, I think we're a brand. And I think there's a bigger picture. I think that's, you know, what we're envisioning for the future. But it all kind of came together really well, but it wasn't overnight, to circle back to that. I really spent literally 2 years, didn't go out, had no love life. I'm single as all hell.
But help like, me.
You know, my friends didn't understand. They all made fun of me. Now they're like, all right, I guess it was worth it. Can we quit our jobs and join you? You're like, no, you're laughing. But that's the truth. I spent a lot of time and energy and money, and I think I think we're in a great position.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think that narrative is really compelling and really good, right? In terms of all those different pillars, from the chefs, the health food aspect of it, you know, that's a very smooth story. And I mean, I guess my question is, you know, 2 years ago, do you have a whiteboard where you had like, you know, chefs and like a circle and like spidering off of that, and then like, you know, health and then like paleo and all this stuff? Or is it kind of like, you know, over time you're like, you know, I want to do something with this jerky and I'm going to start playing around with it and kind of iterate it into it?
I think you mentioned this in one of your questions, but I had a vision from the beginning, and the vision was a female celebrity in Los Angeles walking out of an Equinox, eating a bag of Think jerky and getting organically photographed.
Which female celeb?
I don't know. Mila Kunis? I don't know. All right, cool. Who works out? I don't even know. I just mentioned her.
Jessica Biel works out.
Sure, yeah. So Jessica Biel getting photographed. I mean, and that was the real truth. So how do you get something like that to happen? Well, it has to be healthy. It has to be delicious, and it has to be aesthetically pleasing. And those are three things jerky never was. So it all started with the design, which I did myself, and I'm really proud of that. I think packaging is probably the most, you know, equally as important as the quality of the product. Like, you can have a really good packaged product with a poor product, it won't do well. You can have a really great product with poor packaging, and I don't think it will do well. But the rare times you can get both, you know, can really make something special. But I think it started with health for me. You know, I saw some jerkies emerging, and they weren't grass-fed, and they were super high in sugar, and I know sugar is the future. So for a product that has to have sugar, I wanted to be the lowest sugar on the market. And that's why we're more expensive, not because of the chefs, it's because we're low sugar and we're low salt. And that, to me, was the most important thing. And then cutting the serving size back to make it at an affordable price and just making it as healthy and, you know, unique as possible.
So the sugar piece, then other jerky companies, they have to, like, they basically add sugar to sort of like, what, volumize the product, or what is that?
Yeah, well, you need some sugar if you're making.
I mean, you have to cure something, obviously.
Yeah, if you're making jerky, you have to have some sugar. The reason is sugar is what's called a humectant. It bonds to water and inhibits microbial growth. So you have to have some. There are some who claim to have zero sugar. Then they all had serious bacteria issues. Then they were launching new flavors with sugar. So you need some. The thing that happened with certain competitors, or quote-unquote competitors of ours, they pump it full of sugar because it makes it a much cheaper product. So the sugar bonds to water, so when you bake it and you get the final result, you're actually eating sugar as opposed to beef, and obviously sugar is a lot cheaper. So that's why if you look at some of these other jerkies for a similar size packaging, they're going to have anywhere from 12 to 18 grams of sugar. We have 6. That's a big difference, in my opinion. That's the difference between a health bar and a candy bar. But we're more expensive, and we think people will pay 50 to 75 cents more for a premium product, and that's where we're going to be.
Sure.
So I think, but the interesting point was, or not point, but people think jerky is jerky, you know, but it's not, and people didn't realize how much sugar there can be and is in jerky, because they think it's just the same thing. Because, you know, it's exploding right now, and people want protein, they want low carb and all that, but they don't realize that in jerky you can really pump it full of sugar and just, you're eating sugar. And I think that is drastically changing very quickly, and you can see it in, you know, the turns to the sales at some of these health stores. Well, we're killing everybody. We're the number one seller, and we're in like the worst location. But people realize that when you eat a bag of candy and you don't feel good, you realize I don't want this anymore.
Sure. Yeah. So what has your involvement been in? I guess like food culture and CrossFit and farm to table stuff. Because I mean, I think that the product kind of marries all of those together. Is that something you've been into for a while? And then you just kind of like, hey, you know what? This is a product that needs to exist, or what does that look like for you?
I think it was, I like fitness. I like food. I think there can be things can be healthy and delicious. I think the way we made it's really unique, and it's kind of a perplexing situation. Like, it's literally one of the healthiest things you can eat. So we have the whole health community. We have all the CrossFits. We have the spas. We have that stuff. But then with the chefs and the flavors, and now we have the whole foodie world. And, so to give you some background, we're in the coolest dive bars in Chicago, and we're in the spa at the Four Seasons, and it fits in at both places. That's incredibly unique. So I think for me, it was just more about making something different. I wanted to make it healthy. I think that's where the future is gravitating. That's what people want. That's what I want. Honestly, you asked about market research. I didn't do any market research. I did it myself. I'm like, what do I want? Like, sure. I think I relate to a lot of people. I relate to the fitness people. I relate to foodies. I relate to whatever. I made it for what I would want, because I assume that's what other people want. They just don't know it right now. Like, if you're into jerky, you really only have had a couple options your entire life. So you think that's all there is, but there's now becoming an emergence of more.
Sure. When you were first pitching Think to people, right, either media outlets or, the chefs who you approach or any of that, what did that pitch look like? Was it just kind of like, hey, here's my story and I want to go with this? Were you iterating that over time? What was your process there?
The pitch to media in the beginning?
Yeah. Or when you're first talking to chefs about, coming on board to do the project, or anyone who you were like, hey, like, here's my idea.
Yeah, that's funny. I met these chefs, and these are some of the best chefs in the world. And you have to kind of, when someone says the best chef in the world, you kind of have to put that in an analogy. So Laurent Gras is one of our chefs. He's a 3-star Michelin chef. There's only like 12 who have ever won that award. People don't understand what that means. But if you say he's the same as Michael Jordan or Muhammad Ali or Pablo Picasso, like, he's literally that type of person, people are like, whoa. The guy wakes up at 4 in the morning, bikes for 2 hours, cooks for 16, and does it every single day, doesn't drink those, and like, that's the type of people these are. So that's the level, and you can translate that to whatever field you're in. When I met them, the first thing I said was, I have no clue what I'm doing. The second thing I said was, I'll figure it out. And some were like, all right, you need to leave my restaurant immediately. And some are like, all right, cool. I told them the truth. I always tell people the truth. I'm like, look, I have this idea. I think it's going to work. I think I can do it. Like, let's go. I don't know what I'm doing. I'll figure it out. And it was a really long process. It took us 2 years because I didn't know how to make a flavor. I don't know how to make anything. Now we're making a new flavor now with a new chef, and it's like 10,000 times easier because I already have everything lined up. But that's how I learned. I just start running and I figure it out. The media outlets, how I approached them, I was selling the chefs. I thought that was a much more easy sell in the beginning than the health, because it was so unique and innovative. And I thought they'd be more likely to pick up the story because of the chef component.
Sure.
But the brand is really health. And I think that is why people buy it and repeat buy it. Like, nobody's running to Mariano's. Like, this is, a lot of people disagreed with me in the beginning. They're like, nobody's gonna run out to Mariano's and buy this because Laurent Gras is on the back of the bag. And I'm like, you're exactly right. But Mariano's, I'm gonna get a meeting with them because of Laurent Gras on the back of the bag. And
sure,
Food & Wine Magazine is gonna talk about it because Laurent Gras is on the back of the magazine. And retailers read Food & Wine Magazine. And they're like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
I've always said we're healthy chef-crafted jerky as opposed to chef-crafted healthy jerky, but I think for media it's a little different. And when I approach this, I guess I'm still figuring it out to some extent, because it is really, spread out.
Sure. No, I mean, I think that's super fascinating, where you're basically thinking about who's your target audience for different pieces, right? Where to get in these conversations with Mariano's, you have to appeal to someone who thinks about food all day, right? So how do you pull that lever? Right. And then you also have to have a product that, if it gets carried in Mariano's, is going to be picked up by someone who doesn't necessarily know who the guy on the back of the bag is. Right. I mean, it's like I think about stuff like that sometimes with, you know, certain like TV shows or something that are successful, but also like more like timeless pieces of art, right? I mean, something like, I mean, even Arrested Development. You ever watch that show?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's super funny, and I hate television, but it has like the perfect blend of like highbrow humor, lowbrow humor, like stuff that ties things together so that people who, you know, care about like story or joke development or whatever love it. It has like just slapstick gags so like someone can like watch it with their friends and be drinking and not paying attention and love it. So it just kind of like nails a bunch of different levels. So at some level you did that consciously, right? And that's cool. That's really cool. And be able to pull that lever and get your stuff in that meeting and then have it be good enough that it actually, you know, gets carried and bought by people. So based upon that, do you have any idea what it looks like for a customer, right? Someone who buys it at Mariano's, do you have any idea if they come back and buy it again? Like what's the deal there?
Yeah, I mean, supposedly, I asked the buyers and they say it's like these words like insane, ridiculous, really very good.
Sure.
You know, it sells and it sells well. What's shocking to me, it's like you talk to some of these retailers and because I don't come from this world. I have no experience. And I mean, yeah, I mean, we're the number one seller at Mariano's, Treasure Island, Potash, East Bank Club. We're doing like crazy numbers with because that's our community. I mean, we could potentially do $1 million our first year. I think that's good. But to answer your question, it's funny because to me, it's the most important thing in the world. So I assume everybody thinks it's the most important thing in the world.
Sure.
But nobody knows what it is. Who, you know, you have to get people to try it. So all of our attention is going into demoing so that people, because once people buy it, they get it, they like it, they tell their friends. What's interesting is like a lot of these retailers, like, yeah, we try to move 1 to 2 units a week. Like that's what they consider. I'm like, really? Like it's like shocking how low volume some of these products are. But then they have like 1,000 stores. It
sure.
adds up. So for me, that's just an interesting situation where like a Target or whatever, if we ever get in there one day, like they want to move like 2 units a week. I'm like, that seems
easy.
So low.
Yeah.
Like how is that not possible? Like Walgreens, like I want to move a unit. I'm like, a unit, if I don't sell a unit a week, like I'm living at home with my parents anyway.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But yeah, it's going well. I mean, I think we're doing really well.
Sure. Yeah. And so for you right now, the demoing seems to move the needle the most out of any channel?
Yes. I think, you know, it goes back to our earlier point where people are so obsessed with media and Instagram and all this stuff. I'm like, that doesn't do anything. Like, it really doesn't. Like, I don't think it does anything. Like,
sure.
I've been on national CBS News, WGN twice, Eater, Cranes, Paleo Mag, Tribune twice, all this stuff. Nobody knows who we are. Mm-hmm. The only way they don't know who we are is like, oh, I saw you at Mariano's. Oh, I saw you at South Loop. Oh, I saw you. It's like, yeah, go try some. Oh, I get it. Then they buy it. That's all of our money is demoing a displays, building out our program for that, all internal. We don't want to hire outside people who don't care. Because that's, I think with food, you have to try it. And,
sure.
and once you try it, 80% of people get it right away, and they buy it, and they repeat buy. I mean, I see it. I mean, that they and all the buyers tell us how well we're doing, but, you know, I think.
Sure, sure. So it's just getting jerky in people's hands. It's like,
I think
that
so.
Moves the needle, right? All the other stuff is, I mean, maybe not fluff, but.
I think when you're at a level where you're at every store in the country and then it's like, all right, we need to do a marketing campaign to increase sales 4%, like let's go get a celebrity to tweet it, then it's a different game.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're only in a select amount of stores, like every single company, you know, then it's how do you get people in to go to those stores to buy it? I think there's different levels with marketing, but when you're in, you know, my situation, we're only in a very small group of concentrated stores, so all the money should be in those concentrated stores, building that out. But yes, I think when you get to a level where you're in every Whole Foods, every Target, every whatever, you know, 20,000 stores, then it's like, all right, how do we move the needle? 4%, because that's a huge adjustment, then we need to take an add-on, you know, TV or something.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense. What about this sort of idea of, you know, I don't know how distribution works for food, and it sounds like you've learned recently, but you know, you're sort of doing very well on this local scale. What does scaling up look like for you? What happens next? You try to get carried by a large distributor? Is it just getting in more and more chains? What happens?
Yeah, I see the trajectory of our business as a really exponential growth. I mean, I think it's a grind for the first year. Well, we just got a distribution up last week, and we just got up with two of the biggest national food distributors. We got a Brooklyn distributor, so we're going into bodegas and health stores in New York. We have two potential leads out east. We have one potential out west. I think it's a snowball effect. We're, you know, it usually takes companies 2 to 3 years to get some sort of real distribution. Obviously, I think we're in a different situation just because how we started. The idea would be, for me, has always been, you know, take over the city of Chicago, take over your backyard, get some really high-level stuff in the sense of like a GNC or something national where you don't have to demo, it sells organically or it doesn't. Get some low, where the community is, like the CrossFit gyms, the hotels, all that, and then go after the middle. So for us right now, we're taking over Chicago. We're probably in a couple hundred stores, but then it's, once you get your distribution up, then it's, it just scales out really quick because you can, you know, meet with the buyers, get into the cycle. They know who you are. They're starting to reach out to you. Then that, you know, I think for our product, it was really unique, and nobody, there's three camps with the buyers because our product's really unique. In a booming space, nobody knows where the growth is coming from. It's coming from millennials, moms, and like women, which is a category, which is a demographic that never was buying jerky. You know, it's typically just us and like truckers, like you and me and truckers, like we grew up on this. So now it's, they see all this growth, they don't know where it's coming from. That's where it's coming from. That's what our position is. So when we go to buyer meetings, there's usually three reactions. One is, I go to give my pitch, I open up the product, like you, and they get it, and they're like, all right, we'll take a case of each. Like, you don't have to say anything. Then there's the group who's like, it's too small and too expensive. And then there's the group who typically just sells Jack Links, and they're never gonna get it. The second group is interesting, because then there was a big retailer in Chicago, they had like 10 locations. They said, you know, too small, too expensive. I said, okay. Then they saw some celebrity tweeting about us. So they called me, they gave us a shot, now we're their number one seller, and they get it, and they love us, and we're right by checkout. So I think there's three camps. There's the ones who get it right away, the ones that just don't understand it, but then get it, and the ones who never will. So for us, it's about getting distribution so we can get those first two and just try to take that over and establish ourselves as the healthy jerky in the market.
Sure. So when you get this distribution deal, do you have, I guess, the facilities and the ingredients to be able to just like turn it out? Like, is there an issue surrounding that as well? Or is it just like as many people as want it, you can just keep dialing the knob up?
There's always issues, right? Yeah. I mean, but I positioned the company to be on scale from the beginning. So we're in a factory, everything's made on scale. We have scalable suppliers and everything. So, I mean, we could do 20 to 40 million.
Sure.
If we ever did that.
Sure.
Yeah. But, I mean, I see it all the time. It's like, oh, I just got a damaged delivery. That sucks. Oh, this one, you know, there's always problems. You know, I always wake up like terrified, but in terms of that,
the entrepreneurial story, I always wake up terrified.
Oh yeah. I wake up scared every day. But I just positioned it in a difference. Everything's on scale. I'm trying to outsource and streamline everything. It's put us in the best position for success as soon as possible. So to answer your question, we're not in a commercial kitchen. We're not making it ourselves. Everything's, you know, really professionally done and state-of-the-art stuff.
Sure. So you kind of had that from the get-go. You're like, you know what? Like, my goal is to take this company to this level. Like, I'm not going to put myself in a position where retailer X signs on, and I'm like, okay, thank you, and then I have to figure it out.
Right. And plus, I can't cook.
Okay.
So I want to make it.
Well, I don't know. Get a bunch of dehydrators just like around here.
That sounds like my apartment. Nightmare.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Hurry up. So what does your actual day-to-day look like running a company like this? I mean, are you running around meeting with people? Are you drawing on whiteboards? Like, I mean, you're here now talking to me. What do you actually do on a daily basis?
That's a great question. I started asking that to other people too. It's like, you try to,
because people think that I run a gym. They're like, oh, you just hang out and work out all day. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Right.
Absolutely not.
I think I'm starting to transition now into a need to get more of a bigger picture in some senses. For the first 7 months, it's funny, the first thing I did was order a whiteboard, and I don't think I've ever used it. That's not my personality. I hated school. I hated all that stuff. I had a vision. I just run. So I had this company. I started running. So for the first 7 months, a normal day, you know, I wake up at 6. I don't snooze anymore. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
Wake up at 6.
How'd you pull that off?
I would snooze, and then like I realized how bad it was. So it's good now.
Just got mad at yourself enough.
Like, yeah. I wake up at 6. I meditate, and then I have my coffee and oatmeal. Start working probably about 7 to 9. Then I go to the gym, come back, work from 10 to 12, get lunch. And by work, it's mostly sending emails, just tons of emails.
Pitching people or dealing with distribution issues or All of the above?
It's probably all of the above. The amount of people I can pitch is probably almost close to an end right now in terms of big grocery.
Sure.
You know, we're hiring people to try to go after more of the independents, because what has happened is I start to see, you know, the way I've always worked is I run and I want to learn and then I want to figure it out and then I want to adapt. So now we're at the point where adapting, and I need an office. You know, I work from home. I have one employee. She works from home. That's not a good situation anymore. We need an office and we need roles. So my role is going to be big grocery and marketing. I want some people for independence, and then I want her to run our ambassador program. Then when the distribution comes and there's going to be problems, then we need to get the operations person, then the social media person, then the overall marketing person. I mean, that's the plan.
So you're going to have like a hiring mm-hmm. plan laid out.
Right? I mean, like with one employee, her job role had changed probably 6 times.
Sure.
I don't know what to do.
Can you also do this?
It's like, yeah, now you're doing this. And then she's like, okay. And then that's like, okay, now we're doing this. It's, you just don't know. But I think what you do is you run with a lot of stuff. You see what works, see what doesn't, as long as you can adapt quickly. So that's my plan. I think for me now, I want to focus on big grocery. I want to focus on getting the right accounts, trying to learn. It's hard, and that's what I'm, getting at now, where it's like you're waiting for these big accounts. But when I have like a big account, but not maybe in that right market comes to you, do you turn that down? Is that a bad move to turn it down? Is it bad for the brand perception? Or do you need the money? Or is there any bad profession other than Walmart right now?
Sure.
I mean, do you want to be in a gas station if there's 1,500 stores, or is that going to be bad? But who's it bad for? I don't know. These are questions that I always had a strong conviction for, but I'm starting to listen.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, and it's interesting too, because most people have the problem that no one cares. Like, they're just like screaming into a void. And then all of a sudden, okay, people care. Now what do I do with it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And those are the decisions nobody knows that, you take a lot of advice from people. And, like, you have a crew of people you really respect. And, the worst is when half say one thing and half say the other.
Sure.
You don't want that. You want everybody to say the one thing. So it's like, really? Do I go in there? Like, half? But yours. So, my days are going to be more traveling, right? So I'm... next week I'm going to two grocers, but I don't have a car. If I had a car, like a human being, I'd be going to grocers every day, but it's starting to get more and more. But I think for us, it was really taking over Mariano. It was getting a footprint and a reference point. So
sure.
Once we got that with Mariano's, Treasure Island, Potash, Jim's, all you guys, then I could take that data and go to the next ones and take that data and go to the bigger ones. So it was all about getting the first ones and just killing those and building it out.
Sure, of course. Well, I mean, because anyone, even if you like the idea, there's always that concern of like, okay, if we agree to this and then you can't deliver, then you're out. Then we look like idiots and like, screw you. So yeah, I mean, I get that too. Because I mean, when I get pitched by someone for anything, that's one of the first things. It's like, listen, you don't understand. Like, if I'm going to carry this or let you come and coach classes or whatever, like I'm putting my name next to you. And, I can't just have you not show up.
Right? Right.
So as soon as you have that, whatever reference experience, then you can build upon that. So how do you prioritize all that? Right? Because I mean, that's a lot of stuff in terms of, you could just do anything all the time. Like, how do you figure out what you actually want to work on?
So I think that's what I'm starting to figure out. Like, I've always been good at sales and marketing, and that's what I do. I'm not the best manager. I'm not the best, I don't want to do any of the other, but I've done everything so that I can learn what I want to do and what I don't want to do. I think the future now that we're starting to evolve over the next few months would be I should be going after big accounts. I should be the face to the big accounts, get the bigger accounts, do some marketing, make sure the operation's running. I shouldn't be, if there's a co-op in Wisconsin, that's awesome. Like, I want it. I want to be in there. That's our market. But like, I can't individually sell every co-op in Wisconsin. I need people to do that. And that's what I just don't have the time for, because it's a mental capacity thing and it's also a time thing. But doesn't mean I just need to hire someone to do that.
Sure.
So, we're hiring.
Yeah, I mean, because there's an opportunity cost for you doing that. So one of the things you're looking for then is maybe someone to actually go around and call on smaller accounts.
Yeah.
Cool. Get the
FYI.
Yeah. If anyone out there listening,
Ricky at Think Church.
Yeah, careful with giving out an email address, man.
People, take that back.
People will blow you on. So what for you? Other than hiring, or maybe it is just hiring. What would enable you to have more leverage in terms of growing the company? What would be like a big win for that?
I think experienced people, the right people. I think we have a few key accounts that are coming that could be game changers. I think it's patience too. You know, not doing something stupid because I'm impatient. I'm learning patience. I'm not the most patient person. But in this business, you have to be patient because these the best ones, the best retailers that fit our model, they only reset once a year. So you can't just go in tomorrow. You have to wait and present like a human being. You can't just start blast emailing them. But I think with a few key accounts, more exposure, people getting it right away, I think we can grow it very quickly. I don't know if it's more of the patient thing and the tactical approach or getting experienced people or the one retailer that we hope to be a reference point. I don't know.
Sure.
That's what I'm trying to figure. Do you have any advice on it?
my advice on retail is very limited. I can tell you a lot about lactate endurance progressions and muscle endurance training protocols and a little bit about trying to market gym memberships, but in terms of retail distribution and where to focus your time, I am not the man to ask. But what about long term for you, right? So say, you know, 2-3 years, Think Jerky is in these grocery stores you want to be in, right? You're in these retail chains you want to be in. You have a sales force who is able to, you know, keep growing the base of accounts. You know, you have your distribution all lined up and all that stuff. What is your next goal with it? Are you trying to progress the brand into other avenues of food? What are you looking to do?
Yeah, I think that was always the vision was Think Foods, creating the first brand that's healthy, delicious, and crafted by chefs. I mean, we can go into anything. It'd be the best. I got the chefs making it. We'll have the brand at that point that people know and respect that we could leverage. I think that's at least 2 years away. And it may happen, it may not. You know, I think that was always my plan. Do I think I'm the person that could take it to this ultimate potential? I don't know. I think we're laying the foundation for something very big. And the people who get it, like you, they got it right away. And they see like, oh, I see where this can go. So for me, it was always just, let's lay this foundation, make sure the foundation's strong, make sure, you know, everything from our charity to whatever, you know, our social media is all, you know, thoughtfully laid out for a company that's pretty new. But I do think that's, has always been my vision, is a bigger company with different food items, but that wouldn't be for years because you don't want to, you got to focus. You got to establish something first.
Sure. Yeah. So you kind of have all your medium term whatever metrics and numbers you want to hit, and then as soon as you start to get yourself out of the day-to-day of selling jerky, then you can focus on more stuff. Cool. So I want to go back to that meditation piece. So you mentioned that you meditate twice a day, and you actually do transcendental meditation.
Right.
Cool. Tell me about that. Give me your background there. You know, how do you stick to it? All that type of stuff.
Yeah, I started I think it was 8 years ago in New York City. One of my best friends has always been into it. I was going through like a bad breakup, not jerky related. and I'm like, what do I, he's like, you should go meditate. I'm like, all right, cool.
Sounds good, man.
And I started and it was great. I've never missed a day. It's kind of like working out. Like when you work out and you want to keep working out and you feel good. You know, when you stop, if you work out once a month, it's not as effective as you work out every day. It's the same with meditation. You talk to a lot of people. It's funny because, you know, 8 years ago, I don't want to say taboo, but it wasn't like mainstream or quote unquote cool like it is today. Now it's like, yeah, I meditate. Everybody's like, I meditate. It's like, how often do you meditate? Oh, once a month. Or I listen to an app. It's like, okay. Like if you're going to do something, you should really do it. So I think when you do something every day, it's really powerful and it compounds on itself. So for me, it's been one of the most important things in my life personally. I wish I would take it to different levels and do some more advanced type of stuff, but I just haven't. But it's really a great thing. I'm really passionate. I don't care about a lot in life. I care about, you know, jerky. I care about meditation. I care about veterans. I'm really passionate about them. No relation or anything. It's just like I've always admired, you know, people who sacrifice so we can do whatever we want. They all kind of came together in this awesome charity that we're partners with. And we hope to raise a lot of money and awareness in the next years to come through some of the events that we're going to be doing. Like Think Fest, you guys can come to that.
Cool.
But that's my meditation story.
Yeah, so did you actually go through the TM, like training?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah, I've never done transcendental meditation, but I did a mindfulness-based stress reduction class maybe 2 years ago. And for me, I'm like a lot of people are with working out, where I'll be really good for 2 or 3 weeks and then kind of fall off for 2 or 3 weeks and be like, wait, hold on, I need to do that again, then I'll be good, and then I'll fall off and I'll be good. So, you know, for you, I mean, it just seems like, you're like, okay, like, this makes my life better. I'm not going to screw around with this and just make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, you find time. Yeah. You just have to find time, you know. I think I'm going to, you know, yeah, you have to find time. You know, it's, it ends up being probably, you know, 20 minutes, 23 minutes in the morning, 23 minutes in the evening. But you just have to find time. You know, now my schedule is even more crazy. So I wrote, before I came here, I wrote a note to myself, meditate, to know that when I get home, I have to meditate, because normally I'm already meditating by now. I'm not used to.
Sure. You know, it's throwing a wrench in your plans.
You just make sure you do it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, training is like that. Like, I get it in kind of no matter what, right? I mean, same. I got this cast on my wrist, and, you know, I couldn't train for about 2 weeks, and I was like itching to get back. I was like, yo, like, I need to do this again. Like, come on, like, let's go. So, you know, for me now, I can train again, and, like, you just make it happen. Right. So that makes sense. You mentioned the David Lynch Foundation. Are you a David Lynch fan, or you sort of come to him more through the meditation route?
I definitely came to him through the meditation. I've seen some of the movies. I don't understand any of them. Have you ever seen them?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm a huge David Lynch fan.
I don't understand them.
Yeah. I saw Mulholland Drive was the first one I saw, like, as, like, a...
Did you go to YouTube afterwards to get the breakdown of, like, what actually...
I was, like, I first saw it, I was in high school. I was, like, a depressed, like, punk art teen, like... getting into, like, film or whatever, right. And I'd heard of it, and I was, you know, we watched it, and we're like, that was totally crazy, like, awesome. And then, you know, later I started to get, you know, more knowledgeable and, like, into various forms of art, and I didn't actually know that, you know, David Lynch did Mulholland Drive. Like, I had, you know, heard of him and watched some of his other movies. So I was like, oh, this is the guy who did that other movie that, like, blew my mind as, like, a 14-year-old or whatever. I think that, I remember having this discussion with my friends in high school where I was like, I was kind of, like, annoyed with them, like, trying to figure it out, because I was like, that's not the point. Like, the point of Mulholland Drive is not to, like, decipher the exact story. It's supposed to be, like, a surreal, like, mind-destroying film, and, like, that's what it was.
That's what it was, yeah. You know, I just didn't understand. I just didn't get it. And then I saw it, and I watched some, like, explanations. I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Like, it's really deep.
Oh, yeah.
And I wasn't used to that. But I respect him and his art. I came through him more through the meditation, but, you know, I like his work. You know, Eraserhead, Twin Peaks, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff he's done on meditation. But I think he's been kind of the advocate for it, or one of the, I don't know if pioneer is the right word, because, you know, the Beatles were doing it in the 60s and pioneers, you know. But I think he was kind of trying to bring it more mainstream and take it out of the shadows, quote unquote, you know, into, like, this is cool, like, everybody should be doing this. And now it's becoming mainstream, I would say.
Oh, yeah,
the past
for sure.
Few years.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of entrepreneurial podcasts that are just, like, pushing meditation all the time.
Right.
Which, you know, for me, I think that the biggest value that I experienced from it is just being more self-aware about, like, what you're telling yourself. You know, I know that I was, like, astonished at, like, how much there was a voice in my head just, like, you're an idiot, you're not good enough, you're not trying hard enough, whatever. And I was like, whoa, who's this talking to me? Why is that happening?
Did you find meditation help that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just being self-aware about it, right? Where it's like, you know, that voice may not go away, but you, like...
You understand why it's there.
You don't have to listen to it.
Right.
You just can be like, that thing doesn't matter. Like, right. Why it doesn't do anything. It just kind of nags at you. Shut up. Whatever. Just dissociate from that.
I think we all have that to some extent.
Yeah.
I think it pushes you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I wake up every day, like, scared that I'm going to let my chefs down, you know? Like,
sure.
I think we're doing great. I think we're doing terribly. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. I think we're not doing that good. People probably think I'm, like, crazy.
Yeah, yeah. The whatever, the top food.
Yeah.
This is on Kickstarter every year. Like, what the hell? Like, I thought we were going to get $1 million. We got 50,000. This sucks.
You know, I think we're both very hard on ourselves, and I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. It's definitely a bad thing in certain respects, but I do think it's good to, but you have to balance that. Maybe meditation is the way, but there has to be some balance, because you have to be, I think, critical of yourself.
Sure.
In an honest way.
Yeah.
Because I think it motivates you.
Although I think for a lot of people, especially, like, type A driven people or whatever, you're so hard on yourself, and then it's like, if I let up on myself at all, I'm all of a sudden going to be just like the guy on the couch, like, mm-hmm. you know, slugging beers and watching The Bachelor. And it's like, well, no, not really. Like, you're already, like, this super driven, like, you know, successful person who is doing all this stuff all the time. It's not like you, if you stop telling yourself you suck, you're just going to be like, fuck it. Like, give me Netflix.
I think it's, and I agree, I think it's like you have this edge about you when you're really hard on yourself, and you fear that if you lose that edge, you're going to lose your edge.
Yeah.
But maybe that edge is unnecessary in some ways.
Yeah.
You don't need to always have that edge to be motivated and grind. You can be maybe calm and motivated and grind. But I think in my situation, I don't know if it's like that for you or not, but I think I have this edge when I'm very hard on myself that kind of just like forces me to do things. But I don't know if that's what I'm worried about losing right now.
Sure.
Like, people are like, why don't you go out more? Why don't you have fun? I'm like, and I think it comes down to that edge. Like, I think if I do that and go back to the way I was before this, then my business trajectory would slow down and I would feel responsible to the people who've given me their name that sure. I let them down.
Yeah. I mean, I think the question also then is like, is there another way to motivate yourself other than that edge, I suppose?
I mean, to be honest, man, like, in the situation I'm in the situation, I don't believe in a work-life balance for the first 2 years.
Yeah, it's, I mean, yeah, people say that to me anymore. Too. I'm like, listen, like, I get it and it's valuable, but like,
not right now.
It just can't happen yet.
No, it's not right now. Yeah. Anybody who's talking about work-life balance the first 2 years of being an entrepreneur, I would never, it's like, you're going to fail. Like, yeah. I don't care. I don't believe in a work-life balance. I believe I will take my first vacation around 2018 when the company is somewhat stable and I can, you know, turn off my email for a week. We're not there, and until we get there, I won't be okay. And I think that is what separates good companies from potentially great companies. I think things happen really quick. I think you have to continually be working. I do think you have to balance that to some extent, maybe going out once in a while, but to worry about a work-life balance the first few years you're starting your own business, give me a break. There's no way. I don't, and I think you are in the same boat.
Oh yeah, completely. Well, I mean, I think it's one of those things too, where if I knew exactly what was going to go into running a business, I don't know if I would have done it in the first place, right? Because mm-hmm. you like, oh, cool, I'll figure this out. Like, I'm good, I got this. Like, yeah, I know it's hard, but like, we'll figure it out. And then you're like, 2 years in, you're like, uh-oh, what have I done?
Yeah.
What have I done?
Can't get out either.
There's no light at the end of the tunnel. Like, you know, what do I do?
And, you know, there is a light, though. Like we were talking about earlier, I think there's going to be a lot of change in some industries, maybe yours, maybe not. And then I think the ones who are strong and survive will have, you know, some growth. And I think that is, I don't know if light's the right word, but I think the ones who, you know, keep grinding and stick with it, they're going to have a lot of opportunity. You know, I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, well, for you then, what do you see, you know, after you get out of that, whatever, entrepreneurial pain cave where it's like, I'm growing at this rate, which is awesome, but I don't have the actual cash to hire as many people as I need to, and like the inbound requests are totally overwhelming relative to my own capacity, but like, you know, they're all good problems to have, but I actually think that sort of growing pains phase is more personally destructive than like not having any business, right? Because it's like the demands on your time are just so unreasonable. When you get past that phase, what for you do you foresee as like the, you know, that balance that you find? What are you looking to accomplish there?
What am I looking to accomplish when we have stability?
Yeah.
Honestly.
Like, what do you actually want to spend your time doing?
In Think Jerky or outside of Think Jerky?
Both.
Think Jerky to me was an expression of myself. To me, it's all about art. And I have a lot of art coming, art that I want to do. That's all it ever was. It was really just an artistic expression. You know, the bags I look at as art. I have some cool like movies and installations coming over the next few years, and I say that because I've already kind of planned this out. To me, that's what I want to do, is do cool stuff that nobody's ever done before. Once I get all that out of me in the next couple of years, hopefully, then figure it out. I don't know how to answer that question. I think for me, I see the next 2 years. You know, people have asked me like, what's next? Like, they always think like an entrepreneur usually has the next thing. Like, I have nothing lined up. Everything sure. I do right now is just thinking about the next 4 months, because these are really pivotal. But for me, I think the next couple of years, it's more about just cool marketing stuff, creating a foundation, and then just trying to grow it in a real way. After that, I don't know, maybe I'll open up a CrossFit gym or something.
Don't do it to make any money. I'll show you some spreadsheets about CrossFit gyms.
I would take like a month off, get really bored, and do it all over
again. Yeah, exactly. Ricky, I want to be respectful of your time. So what else should I have asked you that I didn't ask you?
I don't know, man. I think anybody who knows me at this point knows. I think I just believe in hard work. You know, I think it's nothing's easy. I look at you. I look at what you've done. It's not easy. Doing this is not easy. And I think it's all about hard work and, you know, asking for help, asking questions, and just reaching out. And just, I think it's people underestimate how easy it is to ask someone for help. You know, I emailed you guys. That's how I got involved with you. Were you the only gym or box or whatever? I emailed? No. But I emailed you. You got back to me. Now we're friends. I mean, I think it's, you just, people underestimate what it is to work hard and what it is to work efficiently and what it is that really defines success. Like, I look at someone on like one of my chefs who is quote unquote one of the best chefs in the world. Do I think he's significantly more talented than someone else that's in that world? Maybe, maybe not, but he works a lot harder and he sacrificed a lot more, and that's what got him to where he is. And for me, I want to try and do that to the best of my ability. I don't think I'll ever get to his level in whatever I'm doing, because I just don't think I have that. But if I can get a couple levels below, I think that'd be pretty cool.
Sure. There you go. Words of wisdom.